This is The Rotunda, your podcast about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes.
So you're going to have a situation where in the state of Florida, you're going to have one circuit with a death penalty, another circuit without it, all over the place. How is that proper? Why do we need a legislature if we have that?
Your Honor, that is exactly what happens right now.
The Florida Supreme Court hears arguments in the case of State Attorney Aramis Ayala versus Governor Rick Scott.
If a young person, somebody in college, were to come to me and say, hey, I really want to be in print journalism, I don't know that in good conscience, you know, I could tell them, yeah, go for that, go on, be there, do that.
Another one bites the dust in Florida's Capitol Press Corps.
I'm a miracle, I'm alive today, only because of the helicopter. I owe my life, I do.
Plus, the life-saving stories of Air Medical Services and the effort underway to keep their costs down. All that and more coming up on episode 112 of The Rotunda. This week, the United States celebrates its independence, but the July 4th holiday brings mixed feelings for many, especially minorities. People of color wonder, how do you celebrate in these troubling times? In a story published by the Associated Press, blacks, Latinos, and immigrant rights advocates say the aftermath of the 2016 presidential election, recent non-convictions of police officers charged in the shootings of black men, and the stepped-up detention of immigrants and refugees for deportation have them questioning equality, the promise of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in the United States. Certainly food for thought. And we thank you for spending your holiday binge listening The Rotunda.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orange and Osceola County State Attorney Aramis Ayala is suing Governor Rick Scott after he reassigned cases in her jurisdiction to another prosecutor.
Remember the case of State Attorney Aramis Ayala and her decision to not pursue the death penalty.
While I currently do have discretion to pursue death sentences, I have determined that doing so is not in the best interest of this community or the best interest of justice.
Tramell, this case has had ramifications across the state of Florida, right? And there are, you know, questions springing from it as to the validity of the death penalty in Florida, too.
Yes and yes. In fact, Aramis Ayala got her chance to make her case before Florida's Supreme Court. But her hometown newspaper, the Orlando Sentinel, has already ruled she fell flat.
Thank you. We're here today, this morning, on the case of Ayala versus Scott. And counsel, whenever you're ready to proceed.
Here is a bit of the give and take inside the courtroom between the lawyers and the justices, so you can be the judge.
My name is Roy Austin, and I represent State Attorney Aramis Ayala. Governor Rick Scott knows, and just as he told repeatedly citizens of the state of Florida, he does not have the authorization to override the prosecutorial discretion of an elected state attorney. By taking 24 cases away from State Attorney Aramis Ayala, Governor Scott violated the Constitution and the law.
Justice R. Fred Lewis wanted Austin to answer why he thinks Ayala's position lands on prosecutorial discretion when she's made a blanket rule instead of making case-by-case decisions.
It seems to me that discretion is not to ignore Florida law.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, there is nothing in Florida law, that requires State Attorney Ayala to seek the death penalty.
This is not a question about seeking the death penalty. This is a question of following the statute and applying the standards, what you may end up with some with a death penalty and others with not.
Well, Your Honor, I would look closely at 782.04.
Chief Justice Jorge Labarga is skeptical.
So you're going to have a situation where in the state of Florida, you're going to have one circuit with a death penalty, another circuit without it, all over the place. How is that proper? Why do we need a legislature if we have that?
Your Honor, that is exactly what happens right now. Every state attorney is elected by the voters of his or her circuit. And that state attorney makes a decision whether or not they're going to seek the death penalty, whether or not they're going to charge minor marijuana
offenses. On a case-by-case basis, not a blanket disapproval of our law that's in effect in the state of Florida.
Your Honor, I would disagree with you on that, respectfully.
Florida Solicitor General Amit Agarwal represents Governor Scott.
We're talking about whether Governor Scott had a legal authority under Section 27.14, as Justice Lawson emphasized, to reassign the cases that are at issue here. And as to those cases, there's no dispute, as Chief Justice LaBarga pointed out, that the petitioner's position is that there's no circumstance in which the current law can fairly be applied.
Justice Barbara Perriente.
We're really talking about the question of the penalty, the ultimate penalty. And I guess my problem here about whether this is discretion or not, I don't know that it looks like State Attorney Ayala made a decision based on her personal views. She made a decision based on the hard facts that in this state, in the year, say, 2015, only 8 additional defendants went onto death row, whereas over 1,000 individuals were prosecuted and charged with and convicted of manslaughter or homicides. So we have this feeling like the death penalty is all over the state, and we know that prosecutors in Miami-Dade make decisions differently than maybe prosecutors other places. So aren't we dealing, can we talk just about the death penalty rather than whether she didn't prosecute other types of crimes?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Agarwal contends while Ayala based her decision on certain facts, he finds it hard for one person to grasp the entire issue and come to only one possible conclusion. The justices have not given details as to when they will rule in this case. Thanks to Orlando's public radio station, 90.7 WMFE, for having me as a guest on their program, Intersection.
Joined by Tramell Gomes. He's the host of the Rotunda podcast up in Tallahassee. He's been following the story as well. Tramell, thanks for joining us.
This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes with your podcast about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. Be sure to visit rotundapodcast.com. Send us your tweets at Rotunda Podcast. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. Also, feel free to send your generous contribution by visiting rotundapodcast.com, top right-hand corner, and click Donate. When it comes to Florida's Capitol Press Corps, another one bites the dust. I'm hanging out with Brandon Larrabee at one of his favorite spots in Tallahassee, the Southern Public House. Brandon currently reports for the News Service of Florida.
So, you had a secret that you revealed to us on Facebook. What was that secret?
Well, after more than 8 years of being a reporter here in Tallahassee, I've decided that I'm going to go to law school. So I'm going to go to the University of Richmond and try to become a lawyer.
Why?
There are a lot of reasons. Personally, it's just an opportunity to do something new. It's an opportunity to get a little bit more involved in the action as opposed to being a reporter, per se. And I've always kind of had this in the back of my mind as a possible future profession. I do love journalism a lot. The industry is changing a lot, though. And so, you know, I'm ready to try something a little bit different and go to that plan B. You know, I think there's always going to be state house reporting around. There's always going to be journalism of some sort. But it's going to be very, very different in the next 15 or 20 years probably, and I'm still a relatively young guy, not too young, but I've still got 30 or 35 years left in me, I guess. So it was just sort of everything coming together at the right time.
So there's a whole lot to unpack there that you just dropped. Fewer and fewer people are here to really hold people accountable and really tell the story of what's happening in Tallahassee. So what is going on from your point of view as you prepare to leave?
One of the things we are seeing is that new models are somewhat emerging to take up the slack. You know, you've seen news service come in the last 8 or 9 years. They started shortly before I got here, which is where I work now. You've seen Politico come in, and they're starting to do things. You know, there certainly is, I think, if nothing else, a contraction in the number of bureaus here. The number of positions is also falling off a little bit, but even if you were to have a lot of journalists working at News Service and Politico and the Times Herald, for example, if there were only four or five voices covering Tallahassee editorially, that's even different than when every newspaper had somebody here or most of the newspapers had somebody here. And so I think that one of the things that's probably still going to be okay is the statewide coverage, because I think there are going to be enough people always interested in that. One of the things where you might start to see a little bit of fall off are some of the local issues. You know, because if you don't have a bureau reporter here, you know, 9 times out of 10, Politico's not going to be looking out for that. News Service is not going to be looking out for that. The Times Herald isn't going to be looking out for that. The only time that it will really get constant coverage is if you have a bureau reporter from the local paper here.
So what do you make of all these newer models? It's like, is this a good thing? You mentioned they're picking up the slack in some sense. Do you have any concerns with people like you leaving the job?
Not me personally, because I think there are a lot of good reporters here. I think that, you know, I see myself...
You don't see yourself as a good reporter?
Well, not necessarily that. I don't see myself as one of the best in Tallahassee. But I do think that there are a lot of quality reporters. I guess where I get a little bit concerned is I don't see as many young reporters as I would like to see. There are a few. Matt Dixon comes to mind. He's a little bit younger than I am. Tia Mitchell is another fairly relatively young good reporter. But I don't see a lot of, you know, a lot of the younger folks seem to be moving on. And that makes me wonder if in 10 or 15 years, is this going to be a situation where you've got a lot of older people who are looking to move on and not as many people there to replace them?
I can name off a few. We saw the loss of Whitney Ray, Garen Flowers, and these are on the broadcast end, and that's leaving Troy Kinsey holding things for TV. And then, of course, we have Mike Vasalinda and his outfit. Michael Oslin.
Michael Oslin's moving on.
Doing something similar to you, right?
Right. He's going to Harvard, which I'm not going to Harvard. So
that's a lot of money for a job when he leaves.
Yeah, but I was going to say, he's going to be a lot more certain of having a job when he gets out probably than I will. Jessica Bakeman, who's been...
Is she?
And I say this with a little bit of envy, I guess, who's been a real superstar in education reporting. She's moving to WLRN, but, you know, she's probably going to be going down to Miami. So, you know...
Is news to me. I'm now hearing it. So she's going to public radio?
Yes, she's going to public radio.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, when you look at those sorts of things, again, a lot of the younger folks that I've really had an eye on have decided that their future is somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So that's where a little bit of the concern comes in.
One place it just came to mind that I do know there's a lot of young talent, WFSU, in Lynn Hatter. Regan McCarthy,
absolutely.
Sasha Cordner. There are others that, very few, but come to mind. They have a really strong newsroom there, and I'm biased because, I used to, they used to be my people, used to work there. But the broader picture, as you said, is not a lot of people are coming in, young folks. What's pulling them away? Are they seeing the writings on the wall that there's not a strong future?
Well,
here.
One thing, and I know I'm not the first to say this, is if a young person, somebody in college, were to come to me and say, hey, I really want to be in print journalism, I don't know that in good conscience, you know, I could tell them, yeah, go for that, go on, be there, do that. Not because I think that the whole profession is going to go away. There's always going to be some avenue to do what we do. But I do think that there are fewer opportunities than there ever have been before. And there's that in a lot of professions to an extent. But, you know, in some of those professions, there are always going to be people who need to be in those jobs. No matter how much automation we do, you're always going to need a doctor.
Mm-hmm. Greek burger, that's me. No.
Greek.
Oh, yeah.
Lamb is me.
Okay. They look very similar.
Yeah. Fancy fries there at the Southern Public House.
I think there's always going to be doctors, certain professions like that. when you look at journalism, it's an industry that's contracting. Mm-hmm. Its contraction has been very well documented. The attractive jobs tend to be more on the internet side of things, which there are a finite number of those positions here in Tallahassee, and for the most part, people are staying in them. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's an attract. If you're somebody who's come up in this idea of social media and internet are everything, do you want to go work for a legacy newspaper in a not so large capital city, or do you want to, you know, be based out of your apartment in some nicer city, writing about issues, racking up, you know, internet metrics and retweets and likes and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah. What I tell my students is, like, you know, the future is looking more like what I'm doing right now, mm-hmm. where it's broken up. You're being asked to do all these things, be a million person at these legacy newspapers. You have to go and be on social media. You have to go live and you have to start a podcast and this and that. So branching out on your own and doing it, it's looking more like this independence of making your own and creating your own path.
Well, and like you said, you know, I think it's been called the gig economy, you know. It's a lot easier to do that sort of thing if you're writing about national issues or covering national issues, simply because there are more eyeballs there, there are more people to listen there. And, you know, if you look at where a lot of the energy is in journalism, you look at what's going on in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. You look at what's going on at the Washington Post. You know, they're the ones that are getting all the breaking news, all the headlines now. Florida is also very unique in having the kind of Capitol press corps that we have, the kind of raucous, competitive, you know, aggressive press corps that we have. And so I think that that's another thing that's hurting legislative reporting, is it's easier for local papers to cut, so you have a job insecurity problem. And at a lot of these places, it's, you know, remote outposts, and it may not seem as exciting in some ways. Mm-hmm. I would argue what I've done in Tallahassee has been immensely exciting. I could have done it forever.
I enjoy it. That's why,
yes,
I'm still here.
Yeah, I mean, if I hadn't been thinking about this for a long time and hadn't come to a decision that this is what I wanted to do, I would be completely happy here. But I do think it takes experiencing it, and I do think that it depends on which state house you're in. And, you know, Florida has a culture that makes it fun to be a Capitol reporter.
Yeah. So feel free to eat and dig in and chew and all that you want.
This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes, chatting with News Service of Florida reporter Brandon Larrabee.
What will you miss most from being here in Tallahassee, since you're moving all the way to Richmond?
You know, this is going to sound incredibly corny and incredibly trite, but it really is true. I'm going to miss probably the people the most, particularly in the press corps, even a few of the flacks, a few of the PR people. But there is a lot of competition in the press corps as far as getting stories, as far as getting quotes, but it's mostly a friendly competition. You know, sometimes we fight over this press corps matter or that press corps matter, but we're all sort of a big dysfunctional family, I guess, at the mm-hmm. end. You know, we do things like the press skits, which is always fun.
Or your best roles.
Oh, my favorite is probably Don Gates. I love doing that role. I think it's probably my best imitation. His oratory goes on and on and on in circling ascension of greatness.
He does tend to go on and on and on when he gets going.
But I'll tell you, I think he's smart. Mm-hmm. I think he's one of the smarter lawmakers that's come through in my time here. I think a lot of these people are smart.
Who's giving you the toughest time? Your tough interviewer, like the ones that you are like, ugh, gotta deal with this one.
You know who is one of the most difficult people to get information from in any way, and you may be familiar with this, was Charlie Crist. He has this ability to deflect a question
He was smooth.
I've never seen anything like it. I believe it was Aaron Delott, but somebody once, when there was that big question about whether or not he was going to run for the Senate, somebody once was referring to a rumor, and they said, "So, Governor, I read somewhere that we may hear something from you on Monday." And Charlie Crist looked at him and said, "Well, I haven't read that." And then moved on to the next question. And everybody's just kind of groping for a follow-up at that point. Yeah. Because, you couldn't... I was told very early on, never ask Charlie Crist if he's concerned about something.
Mm-hmm.
Because he'll say, "Oh, well, I'm concerned about everything. I'm the governor." So...
he cares for the people.
Most people here will talk to you. There are a few that won't. But most people here will talk to you.
The governor took some time to warm up. It was a big contrast between Charlie Crist and Rick Scott.
But he will talk. I mean that's one of the things. Scott has come a long way on doing those gaggles and being able to, undertake sort of the parry and thrust. He's very focused on his talking points, but that doesn't necessarily set him apart from that many other politicians nowadays.
Does, Floridians have trust in the Capitol Press Corps? Are we even on their radar?
I think that's an interesting... I think, generally, most people probably trust their local papers more and their local TV stations more than they trust the CNNs of the world. When it comes to something like the Capitol Press Corps, I'm not sure. I tend to think we're a little bit less removed, perhaps, than Washington. But there's still a bubble effect. Several of us today, I was talking to you about this before we started recording. Paul Renner becoming the Republican choice for House Speaker after the 2022 elections. Most people are probably not going to know who Paul Renner is in 2022, much less care that he's been elected House Speaker. Now, that's not to say that it's not important, because I think it is. But it also gets to this, what people are more focused on what's important in their narrow lives now. Tallahassee, I think, is more important to them than Washington, but I still do think there's a bubble effect that comes from being up here where things that we think are major news, big deal, people at home look at and say, tell me about it when that bill is done. Tell me about it when the tax cut is done. Tell me about it when I have to know about that because of my life. Every turn of the screw maybe isn't as important to them.
Yeah. What was your best story that you've covered here in Tallahassee?
Best story I covered?
The most game changer. Which one had the most impact?
There was a resolution this past session to apologize for the Groveland 4 incident. There were 4 black men who were accused of raping a white woman. I want to say it was in the late 40s, the exact date slipping away from me a little bit. But they've all since, 2 of them were killed in the immediate aftermath or during the appeals process. One of them died a few years later. One of them died, I think, in 2012. Thurgood Marshall was involved. There's been a book written about it. And finally, the state apologized for it this past year. The legislature apologized for it. And I can remember when a couple of the children of one of the men came to the Capitol, and I can remember his daughter talking about how important it was to her still all these years later that the state of Florida was standing up and saying that it was wrong.
This means a future for Florida. This means a future for children. This means that something positive have come out of something so wrong and so negative and so bad.
That's the voice of Carol Greenlee, daughter of Charles Greenlee, who was one of the Groveland 4.
That was really, I covered that probably at every committee stop it had, and I don't know if it played any role in it or not, but that's one of the favorite things that I've seen happen here is that effort to kind of make up for the past.
Anything else that you'd like to add?
Just that I'm grateful to everybody, here in Tallahassee. I've been treated well. I've learned a lot from everybody here, and Tallahassee is always going to have a special place for me, or a special place in my heart. So.
This is The Rotunda, your podcast about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes. It is listeners like you that support this program, and we also welcome your corporate sponsorship. If you haven't done so, please visit rotundapodcast.com to learn how you can contribute to this program. Also, follow us on social media at Rotunda Podcast, or keep up with everything else I'm doing beyond The Rotunda at Tramell G. Have you ever noticed an air ambulance? You don't often think about them or even think you need one until you do. Congressman Steve Scalise of Louisiana was shot in the hip and taken to a hospital by air ambulance shortly after a gunman opened fire during a congressional baseball practice in Washington last month. He survived, just like Tampa resident Robin Powell, who credits an air ambulance for saving her life.
I never knew at the age of 41 years old I would need it. But thank God it was there. I'm alive now. I'm now different, so I'm not as fast. I know I walk funny now. I don't have all my range of motion like I used to, but I'm alive. It might be takes me longer to take a shower and dress myself as an average woman, but I'm doing it again.
It was a regular day 16 years ago. Well, with an extra flare of excitement in Tampa.
January 27, 2001, and it was Gasparilla Day, and the day before Super Bowl, we had the Ravens and the Giants, and Tampa Bay was hopping. Everybody's coming to Tampa because of Super Bowl.
But for Robin Powell, she thought it was a regular day as she was on a simple mission with her son and his friends.
Just to go to the store. My church was going to have a picnic after church the next day, and the church gave me a little business card. I was going to go like to Sam's and buy it. The pastor's wife told me the stuff to buy. We were just going to do a church picnic afterwards. No big deal, typical thing. We're just on our way to the grocery store, and we never made it.
Powell's life forever changed, altering her voice and her mobility.
At 11:45 a.m., right before 12, we were hit by a drunk driver, and I did not walk away from the crash. There were three boys in the car. My son Chris was driving, and this 21-year-old girl, Nasha Zeria, had worked the night before, but instead of going home to sleep the next morning, she went to an after-hours bottling club and started drinking with some friends. And nobody called her a cab. Nobody made the right choice that morning. And at 11:45 a.m., right before 12, she jumped four lanes across the median and hit us head on.
In Powell's critical condition, an air ambulance was the only way to make it out of Tampa's congested traffic in time for her life to be saved.
At the time of the crash, my son grabbed our cell phone and started screaming for 911, saying, "My mommy's hurt. She's not moving. I need help. I need help." And I remember my car, when the boys got out of the car, my son went to my side. I was in the back, right passenger side, and my son opened my door, and my last words to him were, "Chris, cut my seatbelt, I can't breathe," and my voice was gone.
Powell shared her miraculous story with the Emergency Medical Transportation Working Group that was created by Florida's Office of the Insurance Consumer Advocate. The group is spending a year to study and figure ways to better finance emergency air medical services. A flight like Powell's is expensive, with a medium cost around $10,000.
The problem of where we are right now is the reimbursement is so skewed. In terms of covering that cost. There's a cost study that's been done recently that shows the average cost to operate a base annually is $3 million.
Paul Webster is vice president of Air Methods, the nation's largest air ambulance service. He says the problem of some patients seeing costly service charges stems from insurance companies failing to reimburse, and also from filling in the gap in providing this life-saving service to those without insurance.
Medicare and Medicaid, on an average basis, are reimbursing less than half of that cost. And so when you have a situation like that, it creates an unsustainable system.
There are about 30 air medical bases in Florida, and recently two bases covering Key West and Tallahassee were forced to shut down due to those costs. But the Emergency Medical Transportation Working Group, which includes representatives from ambulance providers, insurers, patient advocates, doctors, and local governments, will take a year to study and find solutions to reimbursement rates for the air medical services. As people like Robin Robin Powell, who was once wheelchair-bound but now is able to walk around the room. She says the service is priceless.
Let's remember lives are most important first. I know we have to have money for things to function, but it's all about lives. I'm a miracle. I'm alive today only because of the helicopter. I owe my life. I do.
That's it for this edition of The Rotunda. Special thanks to WMFE in Orlando. Also, Brandon Larrabee with News Service of Florida and Robin Powell for sharing her story. Remember to follow us at Rotunda Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Also, check us out at rotundapodcast.com, where you can contribute to this program and suggest topics and story ideas. And be sure to join us next week for more stories about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes.